Big Bang. On the Empire Podcast this week, we visit Pizza Planet with the director of Toy Story 4, Josh Cooley. Plus, we get Stockholm Syndrome with the captors Noomi Rapace. All that and more on the movie podcast that just tried to explain the concept of HP sauce to an international journalist and failed miserably. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning, and I want to know what their condiment game is.
I want to know what, I mean, how did you describe HP sauce? This is my favourite condiment. I'm a brown sauce aficionado. But fuck me, I couldn't tell you what's in it. Like, it's got vinegar in it, definitely. It's got brown stuff in it.
No respecter of how podcasts work. A man speaks before he's introduced. A disembodied voice.
You asked about condiment
game.
This is condiment chat.
This is how these things work. You wait until you're introduced.
Oh my gosh.
And then you speak. That's how it works.
I'll fuck you in the establishment. Rebelling.
I wasn't even coming to you first.
Fine.
I was going to Helen O'Hara first.
It's Helen O'Hara. Helen, tell us about your condiment game.
Hello.
Is your favourite condiment something to do with the Winchesters? Is it secretions from the nipples caught in a cup?
How would that even... Don't even tell me how that would work. I don't want to know.
You squeeze her nipples?
No, I don't want to know. I told you I didn't want to know. I don't think they're like a cat.
As we learned from Meet the Parents, you can milk basically anything with nipples.
Including the Winchesters.
No, but because he kind of stumps him with his next question. I have nipples, Greg. Could you milk me? I feel the answer to that question is probably no for most men, ergo, including the Winchesters.
Do men lactate?
This has gone very strange.
Not regularly.
Very fast. They do not. No, they're vestigial.
They're vestigial?
They're vestigial.
Oh my God.
I believe.
God, such a nippleist.
He's the one who keeps bringing them up.
I don't bring them up.
Excuse me, male nipples serve an incredibly valuable function. They let you know when you've waded too far out into the sea. That is their sole purpose.
Also, they let you know if the running top you've bought is chafing.
Yeah.
That's true. It's really important not to wear cotton, guys. Remember to get a sweat-wicking fabric.
Yes, a sweat.
A John-wicking fabric.
If you can find a John Wicking fabric, that's also cool.
Yep.
That's literally cool.
That is also cool. So let's say that your favourite condiment is not secretion du Winchester.
Thanks.
Sauce Odin.
No.
What would it be?
Really boringly, ketchup probably, or mayonnaise.
For fuck's sake.
I don't like brown sauce, I'm sorry.
God. Oh, how can you not like brown sauce?
Because it's glare.
Is your favourite supernatural themed dessert an Ackles cake?
I don't actually like Eccles cakes. I'm sorry I ruined your joke.
You did.
But I like that you made it. You know, you had the knowledge to make that joke, which I don't think Chris would have had.
Well, Eccles cake. Fuck you. I know what an Eccles cake. How dare you? How dare you?
Could you, though, point out Jensen Ackles in a lineup?
Yes, I could.
Are you sure?
Wait. No. Is he the one with the long hair?
Is he?
Is he, though? That's what I'm asking you. No, I asked you first. Is he the one with the long hair? See, I just think of him as nipples.
I know.
So I don't really look at their faces. I just look at their glorious round nipples.
QED, Your Honour. He's the one who's obsessed with Winchester nipples.
Love QED.
Why is this happening?
Why is what happening?
This entire conversation.
Because of sauce of Winchester. Because I recommended HP sauce to an international journalist, and I said, it's great. It's the best thing ever. It's the best sauce ever. I think I made a tactical error. Hang on a second. I should probably introduce. So, speaking for the first time in this podcast, delighted to be joined by our West Wing specialist, James Dyer. Hello, James. Welcome to the podcast. Now you may speak.
Thanks. So, how did you describe HP sauce to a sauce noob?
Well, I said it's the greatest thing ever. It's tangy, but it's slightly spicy, and it transforms anything. And he was like, can you have it with salad? And I was like, no.
Of course you can.
I don't think you can.
Yes, you can.
No, you can.
You can have it in salad. You can have it on toast. You can have it in tea. You can have it in basically everything.
You shouldn't.
You should.
You shouldn't.
All things.
Like, you wouldn't slather it on this microphone and have a go.
I absolutely would.
Yeah,
it's like Marmite. It's completely versatile.
Marmite's not versatile.
No, it is. You can drink Marmite. You can eat Marmite. You can smear it on things. You can spoon it out the jar. It's genius. And HP sauce, I will have. There's almost no food that could not be significantly improved with dollops of HP sauce.
I feel genuinely quite sick right now because I'm having real trouble with the image of HP sauce all over these microphones. It's really disturbing.
Amazing. Like, I don't understand ketchup. Like, ketchup is so insipid compared to the glory of brown sauce.
Maybe some of us like the insipidness.
Maybe you do.
Ketchup is fine on burgers. And enhances. I will have ketchup with a Nando's, but I will have usually HP sauce with everything else. Well, Nando's doesn't offer HP sauce. But anyway, I was at a junket, and for once, just to pull back the curtain a little bit here, UK junkets don't tend to feed their press. Feed the press. They don't tend to do that. They tend to, at best, put on some biscuits. Biscuits.
If you're lucky.
The occasional croissant.
Occasionally a croissant.
But only if it's stale.
Yeah.
And if it's a prestige movie, you might get a pan of chocolate. You might.
Oh.
At best.
The dizzy heights.
But this junket today, can I say what the junket was? Yes, I can. It was Spider-Man Far From Home.
Ooh. Okay.
And so as I was leaving the junket, having conducted my interviews, I popped into what we call the hospitality suite. Or is it what? Actually, I'm calling it that. I don't know what we call it. But anyway, it was a room and all the journalists were in there waiting for their slots. Then there was food. Actual, honest to goodness, food. There was salmon. There was chicken. There were chips.
Wow.
That was it. And there was like a whole, like a tray full of sauces, ketchup and spicy sauce and stuff.
Wow.
And this journalist was holding up HP sauce, looking at it quizzically. And I think I made a tactical error because I said, it's tangy, it's spicy, it's great, it enhances anything. I would not have it in salad though. Don't be weird. But I did say, do you know A1 steak sauce? Because my thing was, it's so much better than A1 steak sauce. But I think just a mere mention of A1 steak sauce turned him off. So he went, no, I'm good. And he put it down.
I'm with him. That's
what the hell is A1
idea.
Steak sauce?
It's like shit HP, but for the States.
Good to know.
I see.
Good to know.
All right.
Okay, good story.
Good.
Hansel.
Happy days are here again. And,
HP, of course, standing for Houses of Parliament.
Mm.
Even though, isn't it like made in another country? Like, I don't think it's...
Yes, it is.
Yeah. I can't remember where.
I think it's Holland.
It's Dutch.
It's going to be great.
It wasn't always.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good point, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll have to stop making it in the House. Here's a question. In the Houses of Parliament, do they have HP sauce on everything? Because you'd think they'd have to. Like, there could be no ketchup. It's like on brand, isn't it? Like, they should have HP sauce with everything.
They have it on chips. They have it on the dreams of the poor that they...
They have it on their...
Let them eat HP sauce.
They have it on their massively subsidised champagne menu.
HP champagne. Yep. Have you ever had Marmite spaghetti?
Again, no.
I made Marmite spaghetti once. Oh, it was great. I'm saying it's so versatile. You just get spaghetti, loads of butter, some olive oil, and a ton of Marmite in it, and you get tangy, spicy, savoury.
You know what?
Marmite's not spicy.
Well, no, but it's savoury. It has a tang.
It's umami,
I suppose. Yeah, umami-y. Mm. It's all about the umami.
But I was watching the chef show last night, the episode where he makes the aglio olio.
I haven't seen it yet. No spoilers, please.
Oh, my God. It's the one he makes at the beginning of the movie Chef.
Oh, the one that seduces Scarlett Johansson.
Yes. And I was watching this and thinking, you know, people say it's unrealistic that Jon Favreau in that movie seduced Scarlett Johansson. And I'm like, have you seen the pasta?
Yeah.
Look at that pasta. That's not unrealistic. That's 100% believable. Anyway.
Anyway, let's have a question.
Oh, thank God.
The question this week comes from @elbows_selbo. They have basically set us a challenge. It's not a question. So we're going to race through this as quick as possible because someone, one of the divas in this room has a hard out.
Covered in HP sauce.
And the question is, so this week it was revealed, in fact it wasn't even this week, a couple of weeks ago it was revealed that Marvel are courting Keanu Reeves from The Eternals. And Kevin Feige has said that they approach Keanu Reeves for almost every film we make.
Mm-hmm.
So Elbow Selbo has said, recast one character in every MCU film with Keanu Reeves.
Okay.
Now we have 23 films. Now we do not want this to go on for more than 45 to 50 minutes. So we have to be very, very quick
about this. If we get stuck on any of them, he just takes the Stan Lee cameo.
Yeah.
With the greatest of respect.
Oh, that's a cop-out.
If we get stuck, I'm just saying.
That is such a cop-out.
All right, fine.
All right, here we go.
Okay.
Iron Man.
Happy Hogan.
No.
Okay.
Coulson.
Coulson.
Imagine him saying S.H.I.E.L.D.
Okay, I'm there.
Just imagine
I'm there. I've done it. Yeah.
Except he doesn't say S.H.I.E.L.D., does he? Pepper Potts. No. All right, I'm saying Coulson. You're saying Happy. Go, James.
I can't remember his name, but the head terrorist in the cave. What was his name?
Oh, the Captain of the Kelvin.
Yes, the Captain of the Kelvin. Yes. No one remembers his name from
that's
Iron Man.
Exactly who I mean, the Captain of the Kelvin.
The Captain of the Kelvin.
Yes, him.
Interesting, because he's a one and done. See, I've introduced Coulson now, and now he's in a whole bunch of movies.
But then you're consigning him to many, many seasons of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and I think that's just harsh.
Hey, that's quite good, actually, these days. And of course, we mean for Randa here as Raza.
That's
of course.
Raza.
Of course. Yes. All right, okay. The Incredible Hulk. Go.
Tim Roth. No.
Yeah. The Abomination. Yeah.
Oh, Tim Roth would be, that'd be good. He would be believable, wouldn't he?
Would. Mm. Yeah.
He would be believable. I'm happy with that. I'd also accept him as Dr. Samuel Stearns. Although, to be honest.
Yeah.
I'd have Bruce him Banner? As the yes. character that Michael K. Williams plays, where he wanders out onto screen, looks up, and then it cuts away from him. You never hear from him or see him again. Never understood why Omar from The Wire is in that film for no reason, but there he is.
All right. Iron Man 2.
Justin Hammer. In always be my maybe mode, you know, in really obnoxious kind of dancing around the place, perfect suit mode.
He's not going to be Whiplash, is he?
Why not?
No.
Why not?
No.
He's too good for Whiplash.
Keanu Reeves, if there's one thing we know about Keanu Reeves, is that he's good at accents.
He can do a bit of Russian, that's true.
Yeah?
Mm.
Can he?
Yeah, and John Wick.
Oh, is that what it is?
I think so.
Okay, let's go with that. Well, he is Belarusian, isn't he?
He is.
Yeah.
He is, yeah. Yeah. Mm. Mm. No, I think Whiplash or... the strawberry vendor who sells Tony Stark some strawberries at the end. Oh! Howard Stark. Boom.
Yeah, no, that does actually work. I did think of that earlier, and then I forgot again.
I'm nailing this.
Okay. Mm.
Right. Film number 4.
Thor.
Correct.
Heimdall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
I mean, knows everything, kind of a bit otherworldly. Come on.
I'd put him as one of the Warriors 3. Not you know, Volstagg, right. But maybe Fandral.
Huh.
But then also, you know, bump up the role.
Yeah, you'd have to bump up the
Okay, rim. Yep, okay. I'm happy to accept both of those. Number 5 is Captain America, the First Avenger, the 17th greatest MCU film.
How dare you, sir?
Which character would he be in that?
Stanley Tucci, Dr. Erskine.
Bucky Barnes.
Howard Stark.
You'd be older Howard Stark and younger Howard Stark, and it would work because he hasn't aged a day in 35 years.
That's fair.
There you go. Nailing this. This is amazing.
But Bucky would actually work because then he has the hair already for the Winter Soldier.
Exactly.
No, he'd have to cut it. It's World War II. He'd have to, like...
He couldn't touch the hair.
Have you seen Speed?
Yeah, it is really good, actually, in that. Hmm.
Yeah, he's got like a buzz cut in
yeah,
that.
Yeah, he works it.
The Avengers.
Well, all of them. All of the Avengers. The whole team. And the Space Gem.
I mean, Coulson would work again, I guess.
Yeah, Coulson would be good. It'd be a big role without taking
the
any...
The guy playing Gallagher?
But just like Christian Slater in Star Trek,
Undiscovered Country.
Undiscovered Country, yeah. So he's just like, was that Keanu Reeves?
Yeah.
And then, yeah, it was. All right, that man's playing Gallagher, and then you go, whoa, as he gets a high score. All right, Iron Man 3. There's a lot of choice in Iron Man 3, by the way.
It is, yeah. Killian, I guess.
Killian. That's a good shout. So you're casting...
I like him as a villain.
You're going bigger than
I
am for the most part.
Yeah, I know.
He's a very versatile actor. I'm going to say the boy.
The boy?
Yeah.
Who was at... in that scene in Endgame.
Yeah.
And whose name... I've already forgotten.
Is
Harley.
Is
Harley.
Young boy.
Young boy. You there.
You there.
Young boy. All right.
That's him.
What day is this?
Or he could have been like the chief glowy henchman.
Yep. James Badgedale's glowy henchman.
Dark World.
Yes. Thor the Dark World. I forgot.
Which we forgot last time we said
Yes, we did. Thor the Dark World. Who would he be in Thor the Dark World? I think he would be...
Loki.
He would be Loki. That's it.
No, he'd be Darcy's intern. What's his name? Kevin the intern. Whatever. Ian.
Ian the intern.
He'd be Ian the intern. Definitely.
I mean, I still stick by Heimdall, but okay.
Don't forget, of course, you're casting Keanu Reeves here. You're taking the person out of the MCU.
You can't.
The person who was so indelible in Thor the Dark World as Ian the intern, you know, I don't even need to do
it. You don't need to tell me.
His performance has been wiped out. So just think...
That would be
long and hard about that, okay?
Mm.
Because obviously that provided a huge fillip to that person's career. Captain America, the Winter Soldier.
Mm-hmm.
All right, okay, go.
Well, I've already said I wanted to be Bucky Barnes, so that's done.
He has the hair for it and just the smolder.
Yeah, he is the Winter Soldier.
I'm trying to think very, very quickly if there are any other characters in that. The specimen guy, maybe?
I mean, he could be one of the World Council leaders, I guess.
But then you take...
Alan from Neighbours.
No! Jim from Neighbours.
But his name is Alan
Dale,
right?
Yeah.
Alan Dale.
All right, no, let's leave him as Bucky Barnes. Okay. All right, fair enough. Mm. Then we have Guardians of the Galaxy. Who would he be in Guardians of the Galaxy?
Could he have Sean Gunn's role?
Londo.
What, you want him to get on his knees as...
No, the other Sean Gunn role.
Oh, right.
He's Londo. Yondu. Londo? Why am I saying Londo?
Fondue.
What the hell is Londo?
Cheese, my
fondue.
Friend.
It's fondue. Fondue Londo. Yes, Yondu. I don't
know. Do you fondue?
I don't know. I don't know what's happening. I'm very tired. I've had a lot of HB sauce. Let's move on.
All right, so he's playing Lobot in Guardians of the Galaxy. I think we've decided that. Let's move on then very, very swiftly to Avengers Age of Ultron.
Ultron.
It'd be great Ultron, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, everyone's happy with that. Then we have...
No strings on me, dude.
Ant-Man.
David Dastmalchian.
No, you can't take Kurt away from David Dastmalchian.
Okay. I want to see him doing Michael Pena's recaps.
But they'd be so much slower.
Oh, but they'd be amazing.
They would be amazing.
They'd be amazing.
No, Michael Pena's indelible in that role. It would have to be the Martin Donovan role, the slippery, shady S.H.I.E.L.D. fella.
It's very small, though.
It is a very small role, but I don't. There's not really a lot else. Yeah, oh, the bad guy, Darren Cross.
Or we could go back to Howard Stark.
We could go back to Howard Stark. He is Howard Stark.
And
Stark. Bucky Barnes. We've established
this. So super confusing.
Moving on.
All right. Okay. So Ant-Man is then followed by Captain America Civil War.
It is.
All right. So who's he playing in Captain America Civil War? Dr. Gozi Agbo, who is found dead.
No.
Okay.
No.
Zemo, right? Zemo?
He'd be good Zemo. Yeah. If we're not having him, obviously, as the Winter Soldier again.
Oh, that's right. Well, he is Bucky Barnes. Okay. Yeah. That Spider-Man. Takes care of himself.
He'd be Spider-Man.
What?
I'm casting him as Spider-Man.
You're insane!
As we have established, he doesn't age. He could be 16, no problem.
No, but like he doesn't age since the age of about 25.
he doesn't look 16.
Well, look, they use CGI to make him Bill and Ted age, and he'd be like Bill and Ted Spider-Man. It'd be amazing.
I mean, that would be delightful. But no, I refuse.
No, it's done.
S.H.I.E.L.D. dude!
It's done.
No, it's not
Excellent.
Done.
Excellent.
It's not done.
It is.
He is Bucky Barnes.
No
and
way.
Yes way.
Oh, God. All right. So then following Captain America Civil War, there was... Helen. I can get this. Wait, no. There was Civil War. And then there was another film. And it was Doctor Strange. Okay, thank you. Doctor Strange.
Oh, the ancient one, without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, definitely the ancient one. Yeah, not even a question.
Absolutely.
And I genuinely... Wasn't this the one where he was actually rumoured to have been offered Doctor Strange? Was that not a rumour?
Well, I think we've established he was offered every single role Marvel have
but
ever
genuinely,
done.
But genuinely, either Doctor Strange or the Ancient One would be super good.
Why wouldn't you have taken Doctor Strange?
Maybe he was busy at the time. We don't know.
Stuff he's made.
I think there was a Lake House convention. He was probably busy.
He got the letter 2 weeks after his mentor. Anyway,
Lake House humour.
It's a deep cut. Spider-Man, no. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Who would he play in that?
Space floozy.
All space floozies played by Keanu Reeves.
Sean Gunn again.
Craglin. That's the name of that character. But then you're taking away Sean Gunn. He's very good in that role.
Well, no, but he also has worked to do his Rocket.
Spider-Man Homecoming.
The teacher.
Which one? There's like a school hill in it.
Yeah, not the headmaster who's played by the grandson of one of the Highland Commandos.
Martin Starr, Mr. Harrington.
Maybe. Yeah, Martin Starr.
The one who takes them I didn't want to lose
not
a
again.
Kid. Not again. Yes. All right. Yes, that's good. But again, you're taking away Martin
Starr. I know. He is
you're
very
You're taking
good.
Bread off his table.
Oh.
James?
I've already said he's Spider-Man. I'm not backing down from that. It's done. It's cast. It's finished.
It's done.
All right. Thor Ragnarok.
He'd be a good games master. Even though I would never want to lose Jeff Goldblum.
That's not a bad shout. Yeah. Valkyrie, I'm saying.
He's got range.
I think he does have range. Need Rocket.
Good answers.
Next film.
Black Panther.
Carl Urban? No. Okay. Yes, Black Panther.
I mean, there's a wealth of roles to choose from here.
It's Martin Freeman's, really, isn't it?
It's Martin Freeman.
Yeah, he's Martin Freeman.
So that means he has to play him in Civil War.
He has to play it actually means he has to go back and take over a role in The Hobbit so we can keep making the Tolkien white guy jokes. It's going to be tough, but...
That's good. Yeah. So hang on. I now have Keanu Reeves in Captain America Civil War playing Bucky Barnes, Spider-Man, and Everett Ross.
Correct.
Yeah,
okay.
That's fine.
All right. I don't see any problem with this.
His beard would be at a slightly different length in each role.
Avengers Infinity War.
Thanos. He's absolutely Thanos.
Dreaded. Run from it. You know, that'd be
Dudes
cool.
Dudes arrive just the same.
Like, I could wipe out half the universe with, like, a click of my fingers, dude.
It'd be at the end where, like, he gets the last gem.
I don't know why he's a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. But.
He gets the last gem and he's about to do it. And everyone goes, no way. And he goes, yes way. Snap.
And then,
he does a little air guitar and then snaps his fingers. Wait, this is done. This is genius. I can't believe this didn't happen.
All right. Okay.
Wow.
All right.
What so, we lost.
Thanos. Wow. Thanos. And then after, why have I forgotten all these films? This should be ingrained in my head. It was, no, don't help me, Helen. Don't help me. Avengers Infinity War was followed that year by Ant-Man and the Wasp, my favourite MCU film.
I mean, since nobody really cares about that film, it really doesn't matter.
You son of a bitch.
Yeah, I'm with him.
You
daughter of a...
Daughter? Of a, no, we're getting into problematic territory here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I genuinely...
Walton Goggins.
Walton Goggins, yeah, it'd have to be Walton Goggins.
Yes, anyone. I love Walton Goggins,
played,
but anyone else.
Sonny Birch.
Oh my God.
How do you know this stuff?
Why
You're like
would
the
you know
lawnmower
this?
Man.
Why would you know this stuff? I honestly, if one of you collapsed to the ground right now, I wouldn't know how to administer CPR. But I do know that Walton Goggins played Sonny Birch in Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Well, that makes me feel safe.
As the only human being alive who's watched it more than once, I guess you would know this.
Captain Marvel.
One of the Skrulls. The main Skrull. Skrull Man. What was his name?
Taylor's.
That's it.
No, because then you lose Ben Mendelsohn's wonder.
Yeah, but then you
replace it with Keanu Reeves.
Yeah, but you free up Ben Mendelsohn to do like literally any role in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which is not a bad thing either.
But he's so good as Talos.
Sure, but also Keanu.
Mm.
But what would Keanu bring to Talos?
Keanu could play, and this is controversial, he could play the cat as Keanu the cat.
Oh my God.
And it becomes super meta.
Oh my
that
God.
That is super meta. But wait, Keanu the kitten was actually cursed with a disease, which meant it would always be a kitten.
Well, no, that's because it was a flurkin.
Oh.
Mm. Yes, and on the 11th hour of the Empire podcast, we finally reached the end of that particular question.
No, we haven't.
Oh, God.
Not even close.
Avengers Endgame.
It's still Thanos. He's not stopped being Thanos.
All right, last one. And I know, Helen, you...
La, 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 la.
Spider-Man Far From Home. He's Spider-Man.
He's Spider-Man.
We've established that. Yeah. He's Spider-Man. All he's right, Spider-Man. Okay. There you go.
Okay.
Keanu Reeves recast in every single Marvel Cinematic Universe. And thank you to the four people who stayed with us through that little segment. If you want to have your question read out in the Empire podcast, there's elbows@_selbo, found out to his and everyone's cost. You can get in touch via a number of methods. We're on Twitter as @EmpireMagazine. You can use the hashtag #EmpirePodcast, or chances are we won't see it. You can Facebook us as well, although... I don't know if nobody ever does. We just never check it. And then there's the email podcast@empire. I'm really selling it, aren't I?
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the email podcast@empireonline.com.
Just use Twitter. For the love of God, just use Twitter.
I mean, that would be probably the best.
It's the only way your question will ever be seen, let's be honest.
It's the best way to go, isn't
it? It's the only way to go.
It's the best way to go. All right, so while we're here, very, very quickly, talking about plugs and plugging things, this hasn't turned into a sex podcast. Don't worry, easy now. Easy, Tigers.
HB Sauce at the ready.
HB Sauce at the ready. We're about to plug some shit. Couple of announcements coming your way. We're doing a live show. How exciting.
Are we?
Oh, yes, we are. Did you not know this?
No, yes. Nobody tells me none.
No, I told you this. I told you this.
You did?
You know about this one at the London Podcast Festival.
We're headlining.
Oh,
you know,
yes.
You know
about
this.
About this.
This isn't
okay.
Like this isn't like last week when
last
I said,
week.
"Hey, we're going to do a live podcast next Saturday," and you went, "What?" And I went, "Oh, you're not free." And you went, "No." And you went, "You're not free." And I went, "Okay, we're not doing a live podcast on Saturday." So, listeners, you don't know how close you came.
Yeah.
You don't know how close you came to a live podcast this week, which reminds me I should check with people. So anyway, we're doing a live podcast at the London Podcast Festival once again. It's on this year in September at King's Place London, our spiritual home. They asked us back once again, and we're going to be doing a live show on September 14th. That's Saturday, September 14th.
Yeah.
And we're going to be doing a 9:30 to 11 p.m. slot. Now, James this week described this as the graveyard slot. I prefer to think of it as we're headlining Glastonbury and we're Foo Fighters.
So everyone else is the other bands and we're Ed Sheeran.
Can I just say, by the way, I'm going to Glastonbury. I'm working on the film tent. Apart from anything else, we have a screening of Yesterday. We're going to have a quiz party weirdness thing.
You got a screen.
You should definitely come along to that. Yeah.
I can't believe you're plugging your tawdry little tent while we're talking about the highlight of the London Podcast Festival.
Yeah, we are Glastonbury. You are just part of Glastonbury. Yeah. We're Glastonbury.
I mean, I'm part of that too. So like, it's, you know.
Oh, that's true.
But if that wasn't enough.
Yeah.
The night before, on Friday, the 13th of September, is the inaugural live Pilot TV podcast, also at the London Film Festival.
Inaugural is a very dangerous word for you to use because it presupposes there will be a second.
Yeah, well, that's true.
You know.
But So tickets are now on the ticket. It's reserved under the name of Keith. It's at the desk now. The ticket is available for Friday the 13th, London Podcast Festival, also at 9:30 p.m.
Lucky for everyone in the audience.
Yes, also at 9:30 p.m. the night before. So think of it as a warm-up act. We are, in many ways, like the fluffer for the Empire podcast, which happens the day after.
Indeed.
Golly.
So, if you want to see us and the other podcasts and loads of amazing podcasts at the London Podcast Festival, once again, they're doing a thing where if you buy three tickets to three shows or more, you get a 15% discount. So go to kingsplace.co.uk and check out the lineup there. It's incredible. It runs over two weekends this September. But do come and see us. Do come and see us. Cannot stress that enough. We're doing 9:30 p.m. We know that's late, but we're going to have a lot of fun.
It's worth it.
It is going to be worth it.
On both nights.
I promise you.
Let's not promise it'll be worth it.
It might be worth it.
We hope it'll be worth it.
There's a possibility it could be worth it.
Yeah.
That seems fair.
Mm. All right. So do that. Kingsplace.co.uk. The other thing I want to talk about is that you can have the Empire podcast recorded in your house or your office or your school, or wherever it is you want us to come and record an episode of the Empire podcast.
As long as it's not a sex dungeon.
Well, actually, I specify sex dungeons. Like, Helen's got one at Glastonbury. That's what your tent is, right?
Again, it's
Helen's
a
sex
tent.
Yeah, a giant sex tent.
Giant cinema tent.
Under the ground.
Above ground level.
The sex tent.
I mean, Glastonbury, famous for mud, so I would devoutly hope it's still above ground level by the time we finish.
Sex mud.
All right.
Really? Oh.
Anyway, you can have the Empire podcast recorded in your house, and all you have to do that is win an auction. We are putting that up as a lot at a really fantastic, worthy auction for Team Monk. A colleague of ours, Lauren Holyoke, her husband has stage 4 bowel cancer, and we're trying to raise a lot of money to fund treatment and prolong his life. And there are all sorts of incredible lots in this auction, one of which is a chance to have us giggling idiots come to your place of work or leisure anywhere in Great Britain as long as you win with a bid. So there you go. All you have to do is go to www.32auctions.com/auction of awesomeness, and awesomeness is spelled AWSOMENESS. So just be careful, as awesomeness is misspelled slightly in the URL. So yeah, we would love to record our podcast in your house, and we would love to see you on September 14th. Right, plugs over.
And 13th.
And one of us would like to see you on September 13th. Let's get on now with our first guest. And our first guest this week is a wonderful Swedish actor, Swedish/Icelandic, now/British as well, I guess, because she lives over here, as I discovered having chatted to her. She is, of course, Noomi Rapace, and she can be found this week in The Captor opposite Ethan Hawke, and a tale of the bank hostage crisis that led to the coining of the term Stockholm Syndrome.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Do we know why it's called The Captor over here? And not Stockholm.
No,
Which seems like a good name for the film.
I imagine they thought that Stockholm was not a good name.
Why?
Because it doesn't really suggest banks and
hostages. No, but it's about
hostages.
Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah, no, it doesn't suggest explosions and sex and
gunfights. So where is it Stockholm? Is it Stockholm everywhere but the UK?
I don't know.
Okay.
All right.
Do you think it's a Brexit thing?
Yes. We won't have the name of these foreign cities in our... I don't know.
You're quite possibly that. Quite possibly. Anyway, it's called The Captor over here. And then we came into this very room this morning and sat in that very seat where Helen has parked her laptop, and we had a great old natter about a great many things. Had a lot of fun with this one. You know what, guys? I hope you do too. Here's Noomi Rapace. Enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by the star of The Captor, Noomi Rapace. How are you?
I'm good.
Good, good, good.
Yeah.
We were just chatting about
London.
Your London life.
Yeah, how much we love London, and London can't get, you know, they have you and they will never lose you.
Yes,
I love London.
Fantastic. What made you fall in love with London?
I think it's such a mix of people. I mean, it's a bit of a cliche, but it feels like it's such a... in my house, I have people that come from all kind of different backgrounds, different religions, different skin colors, different, you know, loud, quiet. Like it's a melting pot of madness. And I feel like London is just a very universal, it's a world city. And I love that it's a boiling pot of creativity and madness.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I felt when I first arrived.
Yeah. And I love a bit of madness. So, but also to be honest, like I find it intelligent and I find people to be kind, you know. Uh-huh. I like just, you know, walking home if you've been out, you know, people are nice to you. Yeah. Taxi drivers are nice, you know. I didn't grow up in a nice country. Like Swedes,
I mean, my assistant is sitting here. She's Swedish too. And you know, we're talking about like there's something Swedish people are very polite, but they're not like they don't
reserved.
Yeah, they're reserved. They guarded. Don't talk to you.
Yep.
They never call you love or sweetie. My first time, my mom came to London. She was stopped at the airport and they searched her bag, but they called her sugar. And she was like, she came to my house and she was like, oh my God, I love this country.
And now she insists upon having her bag searched every time she comes into the airport.
She wants to be called love.
Call me sugar and love. So you've had the full London taxi driver experience. Have you? Does what you do come up?
Yeah, they do recognize me sometimes. Mm-hmm. So the funniest thing was once there was a guy who was like, oh, you do remind me so much of this actress. I was like, oh, really? And he's like, yeah, she's, but she's prettier than you.
Oh,
and
what?
I was like, yeah. And I was like, oh, that's so cool. What's
stop
her name?
The car,
and he
sir.
Was like, no, it was hilarious. One of my favorite conversations.
Oh my God, that's amazing. One thing I haven't done in London at all, which is really weird.
Mm-hmm.
Like I live in Greenwich, I have all this great stuff on my doorstep. I haven't done the touristy things.
Me neither.
We're okay.
Maybe we should go together, you and me.
we're doing this afternoon. Let's check out Buckingham Palace. I think the Queen might be in.
I gotta go to Paris.
Damn it. There's always an excuse.
No, honestly, like, I don't know. I don't like big crowds, and I definitely don't like those tourist things.
Okay. So you have never gone on the sort of double-decker bus that takes you around the city?
Nope.
You're missing out, I think.
You think. Well, I'm curious to see what you report back to me.
I do it in other cities, but
you
not,
do? I don't actually. My best tourist thing is like, you know, if I come to a city, I want to get drunk with the locals, you know. Go deep and go dark. No, but like I feel like those tourist things is like very rarely they reflect on the city and what's really. I mean, I like the real bus. I want to get to know. I was with Krept and Conan last night.
Okay.
We went to this Dior summer party at the V&A.
Yeah.
And we would talk about the music scene. And you know, I'm a big hip-hop and rap fan. And I always like to discover new artists. So, you know, that's something I do when I come to a city. Instead of going to the tourist, you know, things, attractions, I dig into the rap scene.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, when I was on press tour for Bright with Will and Joel Edgerton, you know, we were talking about it and I was like, I found this like amazing Japanese rapper called Ko, and I was like desperately trying to invite him to our party because he was so fucking cool.
That's
what I do instead of tourist stuff.
That is amazing. So you're turning Will Smith onto different rappers.
We do send music to each other actually.
Yeah.
He once said that my music taste makes Snoop Dogg blush because it's so dark. It's like proper. I like Jamaican beats, like I it's quite sexual sometimes.
Oh really?
Yeah,
sexual and dark.
Yeah, but
welcome to the Empire podcast.
Yeah. I mean, full on. You know, when you start listening to the lyrics, I was like, I was sending music. I found this song and I loved it. I was shooting a movie in Toronto, and I was like listening super loud in the trailer every morning, and I was sending it to my friends, a couple of them male friends, and then one of my girls in the trailer, she was Jamaican. She's like, yo, Noomi, have you been listening to the lyrics? I was like, nah. She's like, maybe you should take a look. And I was like, oh, fuck. It's like, you know, I'm going to fuck you like a number one. Nobody needs to know. You
All
know,
right.
I'm going to ride on your big ding dong. It's
oh,
like,
right. Yeah.
It's like full on. And I was like, oh, no, I just send this to Idris Elba. And it's like, this is so wrong.
He's like, what's the hidden message here?
Yeah. I was like, remember, I'm Swedish. It's not my first language.
Oh, my God. You mentioned that English, you know, is not your first language, and in fact you didn't really speak English at all until a few years ago.
No, yeah,
which is that blows my mind because you speak better English than I do for one
That's
thing.
So not true. But
how
I'm
did
a quick
you
learner,
absorb?
You know, it's surviving, I guess. You know, I grew up on a farm, far from everything. Not really any education, no books at home, no newspapers, no TV, no radio. It was quite stripped down. So basically, when I left when I was 15, when I came to Stockholm for the first time, I've never been in an escalator. I could hardly read and write. To be, I mean, it's really, that's the truth. So my Swedish is worse than my English, to be honest. Because I think, you know, when I moved to London, I didn't really speak English. But then I like myself here. And I think as soon as you feel like you like who you become in a place, you know, it just starts flowing in you. And I think it's all about when you relax and you then you can take in information and you know, I'm like a little sponge, you know. I adapt quickly and I learn fast because I kind of feel like, you know, then no one else is going to do it. And yeah, it's always, and also, you know, I've been on my own since I was really young. So, you know, you just survival, you know, you need to, you're like a little animal that shift color, you know, depending on what your background is.
What language do you think in?
English.
English.
Yeah, I was doing interviews in Swedish. I was in New York, had a press day, and I did phoners with Scandinavian press, and it was really hard for me. Which is a bit stupid, but we do speak English at home now. I live with my son, mm-hmm, and my sister and my sister's boyfriend, and my sister's boyfriend is from London.
Yeah.
So when he moved in, my son was like, we can't speak Swedish no more. Like, Lamar's here, you know, we've got to speak English. Otherwise, it's rude. So we just, like, all of us, we just speak English. So it's, yeah. But I did that shift when I was 7, when I moved from Sweden to Iceland.
Yeah.
I just switched to Icelandic, and then I didn't speak Swedish for 2 years. And, you know, so I think, you know, something my brain did in a very early age, and now I've done it again.
And with this movie, The Captor, that's out this week, you are playing Swedish again, but Swedish and English?
Yeah.
Was that weird at all?
It was a bit weird. And I was like, you know, I was sitting with Ethan Hawke in his trailer, you know, and he was like, how do you say, you know, the city name? And he was like, we were practicing Swedish, actually. And yeah, it was hilarious because it's always the other way around, right? You know, Swedes trying to get rid of their accents and stuff like that. But no, it was... But it's based on the Swedish. It's based on this New Yorker, this article in the New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like straight after the real events, but it's based on those like 5-6 days that happened in a bank vault in Stockholm, 1973, and it was something I grew up knowing, hearing about, you know,
yeah,
and I was very fascinated about it because the fact that you know, I remember when I was maybe 14, 15, I was like, how can you fall in love with someone who's like keeping you against your own will? Like, how I was, it was the thing we were talking about in school. So when they sent me the script, I totally fell in love with the story, and I wanted to work with Ethan, so it was a no-brainer.
Yeah, because this is the actual case that originated the term Stockholm syndrome.
Yes,
which is something I think we all know what that is. We've exactly. all grown up with that concept in our lives. So that it's fascinating to see it explored in this film. And I guess it's a pressure cooker of the situation as well. And maybe these you know, two people, your character and Ethan's character, are thrown together.
You don't know if you're going to live tomorrow, you know? And I think, you know, when you are in a very extreme situation, all your senses gets like awakened and wide awake and like open, right?
Mm.
And, you know, you hear about people having sex, you know, under war, when it's a war going on,
yeah,
when
yeah.
you think you know, you might die tomorrow or next
Live
hour.
For the now.
Yeah. And yeah. I also think it's my character, you know, when we start the film, she's quite a little bit of a gray mouse, you know, she works in the bank, she has her life, she has two kids, her husband, you know, 8-to-5 job, it's all the same every day. And then all of a sudden, you know, this madman, charming madman, you know, kind of explodes into her life, and she wakes up, sort of, you know. So even though she's held against her will, I also think he wakes her up, and all of a sudden, you know, she starts seeing things from a different angle, and she's on the phone with the prime minister saying, yes, you know, I want to stay here. They're not that bad, those robbers, you know.
Yeah.
So it's also it's quite interesting because she's strong at the same time, and she falls for him.
Yeah.
So it's a very complex character, and I was very fond of her.
The film doesn't exactly skirt around that. I mean, not to get too spoilerific, but there is a physical scene between you and Ethan, your characters, and that's...
Yeah, they found semen in the bank vault floor, yes. Real,
didn't say that in the Wikipedia page.
Nope. I did my research.
Yeah. Big ding dongs all over the place.
Yes. Maybe there was some Jamaican music going on down there.
Wow. Okay. So with a black light or something. Anyway, we'll get into that. So that's. Did you speak to the real people?
No,
at
I did
all,
not,
or?
Because my character is actually two women merged into one.
He had sex with two women.
No.
Oh, okay.
No, but yeah. I mean, it depends on how you see it. But no, basically, so I think in the real story, there was six of them down in the, like, six three women, two men or something. Mm-hmm. But in this one, we did two women and one man. Yeah. So it was, we changed it slightly. Also because we didn't want to get into this, you know, to do it straight after reality. Because they're still alive, some of them. And it just felt a little bit...
The names have changed.
Yeah. We kind of just a little bit. Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the actually shooting this thing, because again... I imagine A, didn't take that long, and B, you also, it's you, it's Ethan, it's Mark Strong, it's a couple of other actors thrown into this situation.
Basically thrown into
a couple of sets.
Yeah. It was very intense, and it was something I've been wanting to move away a bit from action films and you know, fight sequences and, you know, stunts. I wanted to go in and do something intimate and like a proper drama, you know, with characters and just... explore a relationship, and this felt like the perfect little gift given to me. And it was like 6-7 weeks in Toronto in a bank, and it was very creative, very intense, and we shot it chronologically, so in the end you know, because when I started I was like, oh, I was talking to the director, I was like, I don't know if I can understand, like, what if I don't know when does this Stockholm syndrome actually happen?
What's
when
the point?
Is it like when does she fall for him, like when does her perspective change, when does this, she start seeing it from his eyes, you know, and when does his words become her truth? And then halfway through, I remember there was a day when I was like, in the beginning, I thought like I was a bit intimidated by Ethan. He was so loud and so like much. And I was like, oh, he's a bit aggressive. And then it was one day when I was like totally just in love with him. And I felt like, wow, it happened. I came to the record. I was like, I think it happened. Stockholm syndrome happened. You know, but it was interesting because it almost felt like we got broken down into pieces. You know, I was like unraveling myself as an actress because it was so intense, such a long days.
Yeah.
So we kind of, you know, in the end, when they throw the tear gas in and all that, you know, and it was quite dramatic. And I felt like we were dragged out in daylight, in bright daylight, for the first time in, you know, in 6 weeks.
Because
we really stayed in that very closed environment.
You're in an enclave. I mean, you hear so often about, you know, lots of actors and directors and writers will say that, you know, when you're working on a film with someone, you work in that film really intensely for 6 weeks and you form these lifelong friendships.
Yeah.
And then they disappear over the horizon. And you don't see them again for 10 years later.
But
and for 10 years.
There.
But they're still there. Yeah, they're still part of your life.
Yeah.
Since The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo all those years ago for you, you've had this experience in Hollywood. You know, you've obviously had the likes of Prometheus and the Sherlock Holmes movie, as well as you mentioned. What's that experience been like for you? It's an experience that's brought you to London. Have you enjoyed your Hollywood experiences to date?
Yeah, I mean, 100%, and I feel like I've been very, very lucky and blessed. I've been working, and I'm working with amazing people. It's a bit shocking. I was in New Orleans. We just shot a movie there, and I was I met Sam Rockwell, who came to visit us, and he said, I'm such a big fan of me. And I was like, what? What's happening here? You know, like when my heroes and the people I been following and that I'm obsessed with, when they come to me, they've seen my work, it's just totally unreal. And that's kind of what that happened to me when I met Ridley Scott. You know, he said to me that he's seen my work and he wanted to work with me, and he was like, you don't need to audition, you don't need to prove yourself, I know what you can do, you know. So I've been very I feel very blessed. Some star is shining on me and keeping big strong wings around me. So I feel like I've been able to do what I want to do. I don't really see the industry like Hollywood. It feels very much, it's very directors driven.
Yeah.
So depending on who you work with. And I just finished this big show for Amazon, Jack Ryan, which is a big machinery, a big factory, like, you know, the big dragon, you know, John Krasinski. But you know, in the end of the day, it's just me and John Krasinski standing in there, and he's hilarious. And then you forget that it's like 300 people watching you doing this, you know what I mean? And then, you know, the next day I fly to Iceland and I'm shooting a project there now that is like very, very small, very intimate, and very the weirdest project I've done in years. It's like Yorgos Latsimos meets Lars von Trier, you know.
Oh my
so you
God.
Go from this extreme big sets in New York with on Jack Ryan to this very intimate shoot in Iceland, and I feel like, you know, I just adapt into it, and then that's my reality, and I don't really see it from, you know, kind of an outside perspective, if you know
yeah,
what I mean.
You just see the project, you yeah. just see the directors. Mm-hmm. And what's the project in Iceland?
It's called Lamb.
Okay.
I've basically been delivering baby lambs. I'm not kidding. I've been out in a stable pulling a baby lamb out of a sheep's vagina.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Start yeah. the stars, you mean to go on?
Yeah.
Wow. How was that like for you? How's that experience been?
I mean, it's funny. I think people, you know, it's very, very far from Hollywood. And I think they were expecting me yeah. to come and be like, you know, this kind of Hollywood star. And then I was like, dude, I grew up on a farm. I grew up with dirt under my nails. So I feel like I'm going back to my roots a bit, you know.
And you're also, you know, you've a new project just recently been announced with Vicky Jewson, with whom you worked on,
yeah.
on Close as well.
Yes.
And so you're finding these relationships.
Yeah, I love relationships. Yeah. I love working with the same people, growing, digging deeper. I was texting with Daniel Espinosa yesterday, who's a good friend of mine. We did Child 44. We want to do something else.
Yeah.
I like to come back to people. Uh-huh. And I like when you can be a bit rude, you know, when you have a shortcut, when you don't need to do this kind of polite dance of getting to know each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like to have relationships that you evolve with and you grow with. I want to get old with people that I know, you know? Like, if you like cut the bullshit on me, I've heard this story before. You can't fool me.
And is it different when you find a director that you want to work with again and
yeah.
again?
I mean, you know, the best thing is when you have a director saying you're my muse, you know? You inspire me. And then, you know, when they can see you adapt into different characters and become different personalities. And, you know, I can be fat, I can be skinny, I can be, you know, I can't be taller, but...
You can try. You can wear stilts.
I was trying to convince someone, actually, at some point that I could play a man. I was like, I can be a boy, I can be a man. I look quite boyish. So, I mean, it feels like it's an amazing thing when you have relationship with someone that you can grow with, basically, because you can just go deep. It's like an onion. You can just peel off more and more layers and really go into the core of everything.
Do you find that actors get better as they get older?
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Why is that?
I mean, because
just more experience, or
yeah, and we keep. I mean, it's also, you know, every movie I start from zero. There's one thing, you're like, yeah, you do know, you get older, you have more knowledge, you have a body of work, you know, you have a whole library of things in you. But at the same time, you need to be humble, because it doesn't matter, you know, if I don't do it, if I don't find the honesty in this specific character, it doesn't matter what I've done before. So it's this kind of constant, like, it's almost like a terror balance between knowing and not knowing, you know? Mm. And I love that. And I think, you know, that's why I met Susan Sarandon in LA, and I was totally like blown away by her beauty and her intelligence. And she's so, so beautiful and stunning. And I'm like, you know, she felt so ageless.
Yeah.
And I've seen that with other actors, you know, it's like we don't really, it's almost like its own breed, you know, because we keep, we're like kids.
Yes.
We're like super excited every time and terrified.
And you're right as well. Like the job calls for you to be different things at different times.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
every job is a challenge, you know, something that you haven't done before. That was interesting what you said, that Ridley had said to you, Ridley, like I know him,
yeah.
Ridley had said to you, Sir Ridley, had said to you that, you know, you don't need to prove anything to me.
Yeah.
But I imagine that for most actors, they still, whenever they're starting a new project, they need to prove something to themselves.
Yeah, but that's the thing. You know, I always have, I'm very self-critical and I have, I always want to do better. I analyze myself and I'm quite hard on myself, but I don't compare myself to others, but I do have very high standards. And if I feel like I'm not hitting it, or I'm not going as far as I want or as deep as I want, I'm, you know, I give myself hard, serious talk, you know.
Oh, really?
But, but I also think it's very important to kind of not be too ego, you know, to not get too self-centered. I don't look at myself in the monitor. I you know, I try to stay in it with the other actors and you know, the scene is between me and you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not me and how I look and how I come across, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really important to keep a healthy view on yourself and just like, you know, not be too, it's not all about you, always.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Even though it is. So it's this whole, you know, yes, I'm very self-critical, but sometimes it's like, okay, take a break from yourself. You know, look at the other person. What do you have in front of you? Might be way more interesting.
Excellent. The very last thing I'll ask you is, because we've got to let you go. You've got to go to Paris.
Yeah.
So we've got to let you go. Mm-hmm. But have you sent Susan Sarandon any hardcore Jamaican rap?
Ooh, you know, I think she would like that, actually.
I think she would.
Da-da-da, good idea. I'm going to LA in a couple of weeks. Maybe I come with my boombox, you know, outside of her house.
Who's playing bouncing up on my big ding-dong at 3 in the morning? What's going on?
Could it be Noomi?
Trepass! Get off my lawn!
Or she would be like, come on, let's have a party. She's super, like, she's funny. Yeah. And she's, you know, I remember we went for dinner and she was like, you know, she got good moves. Yeah, so I think she would appreciate some Jamaican tunes.
So you gotta make a movie together now. You gotta get it, you know, the podcast
in
here. And then, yeah, we should do the podcast in Jamaica. You,
okay, done.
Susan Sarandon.
Done. Should we do some tourists? Should we hit some tourist spots
obviously,
in Jamaica?
Yeah.
I think they're quite different from London.
I think they're very different.
Yeah, we can go deep and dark.
Fantastic. It's been an absolute pleasure, Noomi Rapace. Or should I say, Noomi Rap Ace? No?
Honestly,
you've never heard that one before.
Yeah, no, I've heard. So I did, what was it, Letterman, when I was on Letterman, David Letterman, years ago, he said rape ass. You know, it was a rehearsal, but he did say
no
rape ass. And then, like, some producer was like, and I was there and I was like, I got the giggles and I was like, oh God, I'm going to start laughing at him the first thing I do. And then we had to, like, obviously do it again, but Rapace, it's a French name, actually.
It's a French name, Rapace.
Yeah.
Okay, fantastic. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Lead. All right, so that was Noomi Rapace. And now it's time for some movie news. Guys, what's happened? Have you replenished the movie news supply?
You know what? There's been quite a lot this week, I feel like.
There has. And the most important one, Helen, is... Yeah. Go on, do it.
Rosamund Pike has been cast, the first cast member,
God.
For the TV adaptation from Amazon.
Yes.
Of Wheel of Time.
That's right. As I think it is Moraine. She's been confirmed as Moraine.
I believe so.
Moraine of the Aes Sedai.
Yes.
Users of Sidar, the one half of the true source. I love this shit.
Yeah. This is a fantasy world. It's written by a guy called, or was written by a guy called Robert Jordan, who was a, like, best buds basically with George R. R. Martin, certainly professionally speaking, best buds. And they used to swap, you know, tips with each other all the time. Another kind of military historian. So it's another one of these stories where there is kind of a chosen one, but he actually experiences difficulty in trying to sort the world out. So he basically has to save the world from basically the devil. But instead of everybody falling into line when he waves his sword in the air and goes, woo, come with me, everybody goes, no, fuck off. So he has to basically conquer country by country and face all manner of problems and
Trollocs.
Demons and Trollocs, and which are basically orcs by another name. And
is that because they got massive bollocks?
Trollocs,
you know what?
Have the bollocks.
They might.
Troll bollocks.
Let's hope
Trollocs.
Not. Into all this, anyway, Rosamund Pike's character is a sort of, she's kind of a sorceress. It's not so much, she depends on magic. Like
they're like magic nuns.
They are. They're basically like the Bene Gesserit from Dune, aren't they?
Yes, as you so correctly say, Helen, the Bene Gesserit sisterhood from, of course, Dune, being adapted currently by Denis Villeneuve from the book by Frank Herbert.
Thanks, James. Moving on, though. But they are kind of a little bit that way inclined. And they're all female for reasons that will become clear during the story. But basically, this woman turns up in a small town, identifies these three boys as having something weird about them, and basically recruits them and a couple of others to go on an adventure with her. And so begins the story.
That sounds really dodgy.
It does sound dodgy when I put it that way, but trust me, it makes a little bit more sense in person, but it's still a little bit dodgy.
When we talked about this last time, loads of people were like, oh, God, yeah, should I start reading The Wheel of Time? And I was like, should you start reading The Wheel of Time?
Look, it's only 14,800 page book.
It's 14,800 paid books. The first, I mean, let's be honest, 12 or 13 of which are... No, not 12. It's the first of us, 11 or 12. So basically all the Robert Jordan ones are quite boring. But
how
in a good
dare
way.
You, sir.
But when Brandon...
Sorry,
Robert
sorry,
Jordan
sorry,
died...
Sorry. No, hang on a second.
Yes.
Yep.
I kind of stop you there. All right, moving on.
No.
So Robert John died, and Brandon Sanderson took over, and so the last ones are really pacey because he
yeah,
had some real.
Yeah, but almost too pacey, okay. You know. Like he doesn't pause to talk about what people are wearing.
This is where I'm struggling to get my head around. Okay, so you're really excited about the adaptation of a series of books. There are 14 books, and you just wrote off the first 12.
No.
Why should we give a shit?
The story is actually quite good. He's not the paciest writer, and also he names characters odd names.
Sorry,
like Alan.
You're a fan of George R.R. Martin, so you don't get to say shit. At least Robert Jordan practically finished his series of his much longer series before he died and left 1,200 pages of notes and a designated successor.
All of this is fair.
And the last chapter. His series is actually done, unlike some fantasy authors I could mention. So I feel like we're being a little bit harsh here.
Did you not notice, and you pointed out just before we started recording, that one of the producers on this is called, what's his name?
It's called somebody Mandragon.
He's called, there's a producer on this called Mandragon. One of the main characters is called Alan Mandragon.
Dragoran.
I mean,
drunk.
I do find it odd, like that when fancy authors call characters things like Alan, like
I mean,
the apostrophe changes
matter.
Nothing. It's Alan.
Excuse me, as someone with an apostrophe, it's a very important piece of punctuation. Thank you very much.
There's a really good author, Brent Weeks, who I really enjoy, and he wrote this series called The Black Prism, which is fantastic, except for the fact that the main character in it is called Gavin. Like, it's a fancy series with magic, and everyone has magic names except Gavin.
Not to be funny, but you're a huge fan of Dune. Whose hero is called Paul. And
okay.
His mum is Jessica.
Fair. That's fair.
So
it's weird, like, because, and his antagonist, you know, Fade Rautha, they got proper sci-fi names, and then he's just obviously ran out of inspiration. But yeah, we'll go with Paul.
I am fully on board with this. Where's the apostrophe in your name?
It's after the O.
I thought it was an exclamation mark.
What else have we got, Helen?
Let's get some actual film news. There is the news that Pixar have announced their next but one project for 2020.
Yep.
And it is a Pete Docter joint called Soul. Because having delved into the subconscious and every part of the mind and inside out, what's left for him to do but look at the meaning of sentient life itself?
Did we not cover this in Coco?
Outside In.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah, but anyway, I'm basically just here for it. And I tweeted this yesterday, so I'm slightly plagiarizing myself, but I genuinely feel like Pete Docter's Pixar films are one day going to form the basis of a new civilization or religion or both. I don't know.
Up is still the best. I'm very, very on board for a Pete Docter joint, as Helen says.
Sure.
Winners don't do drugs. And very, very excited. But this is out in June next year. And there's two original Pixar movies. Oh, fuck off. There are two original Pixar movies out next year. One is in February or March. And the other one is in the sixth month of the year. Which is exciting. So very, very on board for that. Also, yesterday it was confirmed the official title of the Kingsman prequel, which was news to most people.
Not everyone in this room.
Not everyone in this room.
I see.
But, you know, not everyone in this room signed an NDA either. So we were told at one point last year by Matthew Fallon it was going to be called Kingsman the Great Game, but it's been changed. And I can absolutely see why now, because it is a prequel and it is the King's Man. There's an apostrophe in there, not an exclamation mark. So it would be the King's Man.
Man. Yeah, that wouldn't work, you see.
No, so
yeah.
It's the King's Man.
Mm.
So we know it's, you know, Ray Fiennes and Harris Dickinson and Gemma Arterton and Aaron Taylor-Johnson and all those lovely people.
Lovely.
In an adventure in the early 20th century. How exciting.
Cool.
Good stuff.
Aldous Hodge is on for the Invisible Man film,
yes.
Along with Elizabeth Moss and Storm Reid. That's exciting. He once killed Sam in Supernatural, so that's cool.
Did he?
Yeah.
Nipple twist, was it?
Milked him dry, was it? Nipple cream at the wazoo.
Stabbed him in the back, actually. It was really nasty.
Really?
Yeah, it was mean. But he's gotten obviously nicer since then, I guess. Hey, Lin-Manuel Miranda's had news as well.
Oh.
He's directing an adaptation of Tick, Tick, Boom. It's actually a show written by Jonathan Larson, who wrote Rent. And it's about a struggling writer, basically, who's trying to make the next great American play.
Oh, I've never heard of it.
And the hope is that Andrew Garfield would take the lead, obviously coming off a hit Broadway and West End run as in Angels in America. So that would be fantastic.
Can he sing, the Garfield? Can he sing? He must be able to sing.
Of course he can sing. He can do anything. Look at his hair.
Is there evidence of him singing? There's something at the back of my mind telling me that there is evidence that he can sing. And I can't remember, I can't put my finger on it. He's probably like been singing in films for years and I just haven't noticed.
Yeah, I'm now wondering that myself. I feel like I've heard him sing and I can't think.
I feel I've heard him sing as well, or I've heard of him singing or something. But this is pretty cool. Is Tick Tick Boom a line from Hamilton as well, or am I?
It's a line from, you know,
Boom Shake the Room.
Boom Shake the Room by Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince.
I love those
guys.
It is
also in Hamilton, I'm pretty sure. If so, you can be 100% sure it's an homage to Larson, of whom,
of course,
Lin-Manuel Miranda is a huge fan.
Yes, very excited about that. It's going to be on Netflix. Exciting news that No Ho Hank is Yes Ho Hank. So Anthony Carrigan, if you don't watch Barry is incredible. And Anthony Carrigan is even more incredible. He's so good in Barry as an up-and-coming mob guy. And he has joined a cast of Bill and Ted Face the Music. And he's going to be the bad guy in that movie. So that's exciting news.
I feel like he's the new Death, surely.
My feeling is that he might be the son of Death.
Oh.
That it might be a film that's focusing on offspring. Because we know that Bill and Ted have daughters in this. So perhaps Death also has a son?
That would be amazing.
This is just complete speculation on my part.
Equally, it's genius, so it must be true.
When this news was announced yesterday, Ed Solomon, the writer of the film, co-writer of the film, tweeted this, and I replied to him going, if he's not playing Son of Death, then there's something seriously wrong. And Ed Solomon liked the tweet. I'm taking that as a tacit confirmation that my theory is correct.
Cool.
So there you go. You heard it here first on the Empire Podcast.
Sure.
Anthony Carrigan is playing the Son of Death in Bill and Ted Face the Music.
Very quick extra thing. Blythe Spirit is being filmed for the big screen and they've announced their casting this week. So basically, Dan Stevens plays this, I think, writer who's remarried, got married to his second wife, who's played by Isla Fisher. And while looking for inspiration for a project, he contacts this psychic, this medium, who's a bit of a fraudster, a bit rubbish. She's played by Judi Dench. But what do you know? She actually contacts his dead wife.
What?
His first wife, who's played by Leslie Mann. So she's going to be the spirit that basically comes back and haunts them and basically tries to get her husband killed so they can be together in the afterlife. It's a comedy.
Lols aplenty.
Yeah, no, it's actually quite a fun play. I saw it on stage a few years ago with Angela Lansbury as the medium.
Oh,
so,
God, you went to see it with Angela Lansbury, which would have been
pretty
cool.
I do hang out with her a lot, of course, but on this occasion, she was the one on stage.
Good. Excellent. Yeah. Well done. This is stepping into David Lean and Noel Coward's shoes is no mean feat. So we wish them all the best. And Dan Stevens, of course, Empire Spirit Animal. So
indeed.
Everyone's very happy about that. There's loads of other things to talk about real, real quick as well. So Michael Fassbender is trying to get a new franchise off the ground. It is called Malco, and it's going to be based on a series of books by Gerard Defillier. And there are 200-odd books in this series, which makes Lee Child look lazy, quite frankly. And this one's going to be based on Berlin Checkpoint Charlie, the 29th in this series. And he's going to be playing a gentleman warrior called Malco Linge. Or yes. Ling.
Feels like a spoonerism somewhere.
It really does, doesn't it? And he is a gentleman warrior without a code who works according to his own moral code. Without
then
a country,
he does
rather.
Have a code. Oh,
sorry,
okay.
I meant he doesn't have a country, but he has a moral code. And he lives with a wicked wit and a lust for life.
A wicked witch.
Golly.
A wicked witch and a lusty wife. Wow, this is an extraordinary story.
This sounds right up Fassbender Street. So yes, very, very exciting indeed. Jermaine Fowler is joining the cast of Coming to America, which is the sequel to Coming to America. But you have to imagine one has the number two and one has the word two. So
yes, of course, the original had the number two and now this one has T-O.
They've announced a Hunger Games prequel. How do we feel about this?
Wildly indifferent, but so the book, we don't know an awful lot about the book. So the book, I assumed, if it's going to be a Hunger Games, it's a prequel, I assumed it would be like the fall of Pan Am, like how it breaks down into, you know, Civil War. But apparently it happens sometime after that, during the first decade of the Hunger Games.
Yeah, like so, 64 years before.
So it feels a lot like just an excuse to have another Hunger Games.
Yeah, we got to hope there's a bit more to it, but that would be my worry as well. Like, there has to be something different. And again, you know, my slight antipathy towards prequels, if you really need to show me something that I care about and don't know yet. So hopefully that's what this will do. But yeah, the last book in the series was a bit disappointing, so I'm hoping that this is a better book and
Yeah, I do remember the scene where Katniss shines a light on a wall and a cat bats at it with its paw for at least 45 to 50 minutes. So that was unexpected and unneeded. Yes.
I'm expecting this, of course, this will be a film as well, produced by Lionsgate, and I'm expecting it to be broken into 45 parts. Richard E. Grant and Sharon Horgan have joined the cast of Everybody's Talking About Jamie, which is an adaptation of the hit West End musical. I haven't seen it, Helen. Have you seen it?
I have, yes.
Is it good?
It's pretty good. Yeah, good, it's
good
interesting.
Songs?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are good. I like it. It was
excellent.
Fun.
All right, and I think that's pretty much it on the news front.
I mean,
I don't think
pretty much
else
nothing else. No big films
about
that may have another. Hang on a second.
Wait, what?
You just mentioned spoiler podcast. That reminds me of one we did. Do you remember a film called Avengers Endgame?
The one that came so close to being the biggest movie of all time, but didn't quite make it.
Yeah, so like the biggest movie of all time, will be re-released into cinemas in the hope of getting a little bit more extra cash.
Yes, I love the fact that they've done this. The fact that they've said, we came so close, we didn't quite make it, so no, we're not going to leave it there. We are absolutely taking this away from Avatar. And so they've tacked a few extra goodies onto the end of the film,
yes,
and they're re-releasing it.
Kevin Feige just counting money
in his big money house.
In a post-credit sting. Avengers Endgame is being re-released. Avengers Endgame is being re-released into cinemas next weekend. Now, is that definitely over here as well? Because we'll have to go next week just to check it out, right?
Yeah, of
course. We will have to go. And then hopefully it'll have the extra footage and whatnot.
It's all right. It'll be on in the Glastonbury film tent. So yeah.
The extra footage is worth mentioning is not actually in the film. This is purely end credit stuff.
Is it?
Yes, I believe it's almost like a trail for the home end stuff, for the goodies on the DVD.
I mean,
that's not really like what they're implying. They're implying it's a bit more substantive than that.
Hello.
At the very least, I think, okay, this is obviously a cynical attempt to go past Avatar.
Fully.
I don't think they're even pretending it isn't.
No one's pretending otherwise. Cynical. But here's my hope. My hope is that the Russos have taken that cynical attempt to go past Avatar and used it to do something fun. And as long as that is the case, I will be super happy. Even if they are literally eating shawarma and just talking, super happy.
I hope it's extended scenes within the context of the film. I hope it's stuff that we know that was shot but didn't make it. Things like people's conversations with other characters who maybe didn't make it to the end of the film after they have done a certain thing with a certain gauntlet.
Uh-huh.
So maybe something like that. Or, you know, just like I said before, just interstitials, just Kevin Feige counting this money, Robert Downey Jr. picking out a new conservatory. I just want to see that kind of stuff just studded through the movie, and that would be pretty awesome.
I'd be here for it.
All right. Okay. So very, very exciting news indeed. And I don't think we're going to be doing a new spoiler special for this, but you never know. We may tack another hour or so onto the one that we released a few
weeks
ago.
I feel like there's a lot we didn't cover.
There's a lot we didn't cover. We didn't cover minutes 47 and minutes 391. So we need to get into that. Anyway, time now to hear from this week's sponsor, because once again, we're delighted, nay, overwhelmed, to have the legendary magazine The Economist sponsor this week's pod. You think they'd have learned their lesson, but no, here they are back for more. And as ever, we have an incredible offer for all Empire Podcast listeners who are based in the United Kingdom. You can get your mitts on a free print copy of The Economist. Did I mention how much it was, Helen?
No.
It's free.
Ooh.
Absolutely free. And if you don't already subscribe to The Economist, then let me fill you in. It's been around for over 175 years and is a veritable institution, just like Helen's sex tent at Glastonbury.
What? No.
It is your one-stop shop for incredible, insightful articles about economics, politics, entertainment, and the world around us. Articles like the one, for example, that caught my eye this week about how business is booming in space.
Ooh.
With many companies responsible for launching tiny satellites known as smallsats, all one word, nanosats, all one word, or cubesats, all one word, into space, with many more to come over the next few years. Now, many of these can be used for purposes like data storage or surveillance of illegal shipping activity. That's shipping as in ships that actually go in the water and not, oh, I like those two fictional characters and I hope they get it on.
Gotcha.
Just want to make that absolutely clear. Now, these things will make our lives down here on Earth much easier, but with such an expansion comes problems. Not only could one satellite out of place, even a little bit, start a chain reaction of collisions that might incapacitate the entire low Earth orbit ecosystem in a heartbeat, but now companies are beginning to vie for space in space and dominance of said space in space. which could get very interesting indeed. And all this could form either the basis for the next Aaron Sorkin movie, because it would be very, very smart people talking in rooms, or the next Michael Bay movie, because it would be people in space trying to stop satellites from blowing up. Or maybe the first Aaron Sorkin Michael Bay movie. Now there's a thought. And that's just one of the many brilliant articles in this week's Economist, articles that will expand your mind and give you brand new insight into the way the world works. And we are once again, as I said, offering all UK-based Empire Podcast listeners an incredible offer, a free print copy of The Economist to get your ball rolling. And again, it's free. Gratis. No money will change hands. All you have to do is text the word movies. Movies to 78070. And before you know it, you'll be up to your eyeballs in great articles. So, movies. Movies 78070. And thanks once again to The Economist for sponsoring the show. Okay, time now for our second and final guest this week, and he is Josh Cooley. And he is the director of Toy Story 4, which sees all your favourite characters from the previous Toy Story movies. So Buzzy, Woodmeister, the Bo Peeps, the dinosaur one, the piggy bank one, and the one that goes down the stairs really fast. Loads ones. So Josh Cooley is the director of this. He has been at Pixar for a while. He was story supervisor on Inside Out, and now he is director on Toy Story 4. And we sent John Nugent along to have a good old natter with him about Woody, Buzz, and all the gang. Yeah, I can name them. Bo Peep, Rex, Ham, Slinky. See?
Amazing.
I got it.
You got it.
I got it. Absolutely. Here we are. Josh Cooley talking to John Nugent. Enjoy.
Josh Cooley, director of Toy Story 4. Welcome to the Empire Podcast.
Thank you so much.
How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
You made me cry three times.
I think that's your problem.
This was not, you didn't hurt my feelings or anything. It's okay.
Okay.
This wasn't any slight. No, Toy Story 4 was, it really got to me.
I'm glad to hear that. That's always the goal.
I did wonder, was it an emotional roller coaster for you? Did it make you cry in the making of it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, this is my first feature film as director.
Yes.
And so there's a lot to learn and a lot to experience. And just the fact that this is Toy Story is already a huge amount of pressure.
Yeah.
But I was so honored to be asked to do it. But there's, you know, making these films, they are emotional films, not only just trying to make something that touches people. But I remember the first time that really hit me, we were making a Toy Story film, was, you know, we'd already recorded Tom and Tim and done a bunch of animation and stuff. But the very first recording session with Randy Newman and hearing his music against the picture of the film just was overwhelming. And I started just crying.
Yeah.
Couldn't help it.
That's amazing.
That's when I was like, now we're making Toy Story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's funnily enough that the opening titles, that was the first cry for me, because it was like I was 7 years old again. You know that you've got a friend in me.
Yeah,
that takes you back to being where you were as a kid.
Absolutely, and that was the goal, is to in that moment remind you of those films, just so that when Woody is starting to feel nostalgic and talk about that later on, you're right there with him. You understand.
So what was your first experience of the first Toy Story? Like, what was your entry point?
Well, I remember going to see it with my younger brother in our hometown. And I always wanted to work in animation. So I was kind of taking in everything that was animated at that time. Mm-hmm. And my brother and I were sitting there. But obviously, it was totally different because it's the first CG film ever. But on top of that, just the story was so different from everything else that was being done at the time. There was no princesses in it. There was no villain in it. There was no songs that were being sung by the characters of, you know, an I Want song or anything like that. So already it felt completely different from anything I'd ever seen.
Yeah. And so was it surreal to then be handed the keys to this, basically the sort of flagship franchise of the studio?
Yeah, that's exactly it.
And yeah.
I always think of these characters almost like the Mickey, Donald, Goofy of Pixar, because they are, you know, every single one of our films is possible because of Toy Story.
Yeah.
And to be given the keys to that Ferrari and be like, I've never driven a car before. And you go, here you go.
Yeah.
And but luckily I had so many people on the cast or on the crew and cast that were so such supportive people and great collaborators that I never felt alone.
Yeah, I was trying to think of how many like fourth films in a series there are that don't suck. You know,
I tried to not think about that while we were making it.
But I was going to ask, did you look at any sequels and like see how they work like at this stage in a series?
The only sequels that I looked at were Toy Story 1, 2, or Toy Story 2 and 3.
Yeah,
because we didn't want to make we wanted to make sure that we didn't do anything we've already done. And I think that's kind of the curse of a sequel, is that you don't want to repeat something, because the second you do, the audience goes, I've seen this. Yeah. I'm done.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they want to re-experience what they know.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very hard line to walk. And I, you know, especially with a fourth film, you've done so much already with Woody. Yeah. And we were starting it off by going, where can we take this? Where can we take him from here?
Yeah. But I mean, you know, it seems to have worked. It's been incredibly well received. As we speak, it's 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
I can't believe that.
It's not bad for your first film.
I can't believe it.
Do you pay much attention to that sort of thing? Or?
Well, I pay attention to the audience. I hadn't really thought about this, but I guess the goal is always to have the audience respond to the film. Like I'm trying to emotionally convey something through the screen. And so I love sitting in the audience after a film that I've worked on comes out and just experiencing it with them and just seeing how they respond.
Yeah. There's so much to respond to here. I wanted to talk a little bit about Bo Peep. I love what you've done with her in this film. Because essentially in the first film, she's almost like a supporting character.
She is, yeah.
And in this sequel, you get a chance to flesh her out and look into her sort of inner life, I guess.
That was one of the things that got me really excited about the film. Mm. In Toy Story 3, there's one mention of her. She's not in the movie at all, but somebody mentions Bo Peep. Rex does, and Woody goes, yeah, we even lost Bo. And it's so emotional, just that little moment. And so to be able to give the chance to answer what happened to her and to see that relationship kind of come apart was exciting to do just on screen. And then to bring her back in a way that is totally different from what we've known. And the interesting thing is we went back and watched 1 and 2 and just looked at the Bo Peep scenes. She's only in about 6 minutes of the combined movies. But what she does is whenever Woody is feeling crazy, is like, where's my hat? Whatever. She says, Woody, look under your boot. Look whose name's under there.
Yeah.
Andy cares about you. And she kind of puts him right back on the right track. So she's always been this tertiary supportive character. And we looked at that when all we have to do is bring her to the forefront. She's already strong. She's already kind of awesome. Mm. Let's just put her through this situation for 9 years where she's living on her own. And that just naturally became this strong character who's a survivor.
And I'm fascinated by those 9 years. Like, did you discuss, I mean, there's almost another Toy Story film in it, like the adventures she gets up to on the road. Like, did you discuss what she'd been up to in the intervening years?
Yeah, we actually had sequences in, you know, different versions of the movie we had done over the years. We had scenes where we actually saw the whole thing. Everything that had happened to her. And then we quickly realized, yeah, it's cool to get the answers, but you actually don't need to know exactly everything.
Yeah.
All we need to see is that it's tough out there for a toy, which we've set up in all three Toy Story films, and that she's cool with it. And that was enough to kind of, she goes, yeah, they, you know, threw me out and then whatever. Like, Woody's like, what?
Yeah. There's so many amazing new toys to talk about. I love Forky. I mean, I love it. In the first Toy Story, you're introduced Buzz, who's kind of like the ultimate toy. And in Forky, you kind of get, respectfully, the crappiest toy.
Yes.
Was that the genesis? He's almost like the anti-Buzz?
Well, but the genesis even before that was we were just sitting around the story room just making stupid jokes and saying, you know, we were looking at our own kids and how they actually play with anything.
Yeah.
My kid will pick up a rock and go, and now it's a person, you know? Yeah. So we were saying, well, if that happened in Toy Story, would that mean the rock's alive? Does it have eyes and a mouth all of a sudden? Like, how does that work?
Yeah.
And so just that idea of a kid playing with something, having that imagination and, we decided, what if Bonnie made a toy, like made something out of something else? and that toy comes to life, and that toy has never seen Toy Story 1 through 3, doesn't understand the rules of the world, or any, it would be like if we were dropped onto an alien planet and expected to be the king of that planet. It would be like, what is going on? So I already loved just the idea of that.
Yeah.
And then it became even better when we realized he can actually force Woody to explain his mindset and explain what it means to be a toy.
Yeah. He's, I mean, he's like an instant hit, this character, especially with Tony Hale's performance.
Oh, Tony. When we were talking about this character, Tony was the first name that popped into our heads.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad he said yes. We pitched it to him and said, this character is doesn't understand anything and is afraid of everything. And he went, okay, I could do that.
He's amazing. And I love that he's already got his own spin-off TV show for Disney Plus. I mean, did you know early on you had sort of something special that...
Well, you know, it felt like a brand new take on toys, and anything that felt new for a fourth film was precious, and we're like, we have to go down that path and explore it, because after four films, you know, there's a lot that has already been done.
Mm.
So we worked on that character, and we worked with Tony to create his voice and also his mindset, and that's what came out.
I also love Duke Kaboom. He's a bit of a scene stealer. And you're riding the crest of the Keanu Renaissance, as people are calling it. Like, he's having a moment right now.
Oh, yeah, which he totally deserves.
Yeah.
We cast him 2 years ago. We had no idea that this would be a thing. But he was so amazing to work with.
Yeah.
And that character is so funny and has so much pathos because of Keanu. I credit him for that. All we had was the idea of this character and kind of the name and just the idea that he's a stuntman. And when he came to the studio before he even said yes, he just came to talk about the character and talk about the story. And so I pitched it all to him, and he would ask these amazing character questions about Duke that I was not prepared for, because I kind of thought it was like a side joke.
Right? Yeah.
But he would say things like, what is this character? What is he afraid of? You know? And I'd be like, oh man. Well, you know. And he said, is he mad at the world or is he mad at his commercial? Which one? I'm like, oh, well, that's a great question. I think he'd be mad at he's mad at the marketing department for saying that he can do things he can't do for real, right? And he'd go, okay, that's great. Right? And so then, We were crafting this character together, and we were having lunch in the Pixar atrium, and he was saying he's a action figure, right? And I said, yeah, so he does poses. And so he was going, huh, ha, huh, hoo, like going from pose to pose. And I start laughing so hard because this is genius. And to the point where Keanu stood up on the table and went, I'm Duke Kaboom! And it was like, wow, this is the character. And so I was so thrilled when he said yes, because I had already seen the character. He was doing it. And so it's all there in the movie. It's all Keanu.
That's amazing. That's an amazing Keanu impression, by the way. You nailed him.
I've been listening to him for the last 3 years.
That's brilliant. Well, whatever happens in the future, hope to see more Toy Story. Josh Cooley, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
That was Josh Cooley, and now it is time to delve deep into this week's reviews, and we're going to start with Brightburn. Jimbo.
Yes, this is the film that was announced at roughly the same time that James Gunn dropped out of Guardians of the Galaxy 3, and got its announcement, I think, got slightly overshadowed by that whole event. But this is, so he's producing this film, and this is a very simple premise. It's, what if Superman was evil?
Evil!
So this sees Elizabeth Banks and David Denman as a couple living in rural Kansas, specifically Brightburn, Kansas, wanting a child, which is handled in an incredibly subtle, you would never know they were trying to get a child, as the camera passes through 15 different books on fertility and then them having sex saying, I wonder if we'll have a child this time. Anyway, and then a meteorite crashes in the forest, and lo and behold, 'tis a small, bouncing, bonny baby boy.
Aww.
Who turns out to be a super-powered monster.
No!
Yes! As this plays out, he starts to come into his powers and uses them to do such things as crush a girl's hand, perv on her in her bedroom, and then start murderizing the shit out of people. So this isn't good, which is a real shame, because I really love this premise. It's a great idea. I mean, it's been explored a little bit in comics. Like Red Sun, it's not really if he was evil, it's just if he was a communist.
Mm.
But like, I love the idea of this. Like, what if Superman was fundamentally a bad guy. But I feel there was more interesting stuff you could have done with this. Like, yeah. Is it a nature versus nurture thing? Would it have been, what if normal Superman had arrived with like a horrible couple, not the Kents? You know, and maybe that, but it's not. They're a lovely couple, and yet he is just amoral, and he's a small superpowered sociopath. And it's very gory, it's quite sadistic, but it doesn't do anything clever, it doesn't do anything new. And with no real basis other than my own theories, this feels like a prime example of what happens when nepotism goes wrong. Because this is written by two guns. Am I right saying they're James Gunn's cousins?
One cousin, one brother.
One cousin and one brother. And I know nothing about this and I have no evidence for this, but it feels a little bit like they wanted to get this film made and his name has been used to grease the wheels and this has got made.
I think
because
that's
Because I can't
harsh.
Think of many other reasons why this would have got made.
Oh, I think that's way harsher. I mean, I agree that there's some shortcomings here, but I feel like the premise is really strong.
Yes, it's brilliant.
There are lots of strong scenes. I think things may have been lost along the way. Yeah, like I think the stalking of the little girl scene is super creepy. Super creepy.
Mm. And then super forgotten about.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. But that's one of the problems. But I feel like, you know, if you were reading the script, you could latch on to the premise and those ideas and go, brilliant, let's make it. We'll sort out the problems later and then just forget. Yeah. And I feel like that's maybe what's happened. I feel like also, you know, there's an implication that basically, you know, something in the pod, something in the meteor has kind of triggered this change in him, that there has been a shift in his personality. But that's never really explored, beyond the fact that he just does bad things. There's no sense of, this isn't our son anymore. You're not clear on whether something that was always in him has just started to come out, or if something has fundamentally, essentially killed the son that they had and taken his place.
Motiveless malignancy seems to kind of be all over the place.
He's like a one-man sleeper cell, isn't he? That seems... It seems to be that's the way that the film is going.
But the Midwich Cuckoos did that brilliantly, and then this just doesn't quite
It doesn't,
manage.
And I think it's a missed opportunity. It's not particularly well written. The sense of dread didn't really work for me. They used exclusively jump scares in place of actual sort of fear building. And gore, again, it does not make for a scary film. And you do also have that slight problem, which is Superman as a hero is problematically overpowered. And now you have the opposite situation where, as a psychopathic killer, he's stupidly overpowered. And the way he kills people, it's just like he could do it in a million different ways because he's essentially godlike.
Yeah, and that would work if he was conflicted about it somehow, or if there was a sense of the good guy still in there, or if there's, you know, there's some way, but that isn't really brought out. That isn't really something that they play with.
Yeah, there's no sense of inner conflict at all. No. For example, you know, this movie brought to mind occasionally Damien Omen 2, which is a sequel to The Omen, in case you didn't know, and in that, Damien is around the same age. I think probably is the same age because it kind of echoes the Bible. He's a kid, then he's 12, and then he's in his 30s. And so there's a moment in that where Damien, many moments in that where Damien is told his destiny and told what awaits him as the Antichrist, and he struggles with it, and he struggles with conflict and with guilt. And there's a moment where his cousin finds out and he kills his cousin, but he's kind of torn up about it a little bit. There's nothing like that in this movie at all. I think it's a bit of a wasted opportunity. I thought it was a bit dull and rote, sadly. And the second, we'll get on to the other one in a second, but the second horror movie this week to be filled with just really stupid people doing ridiculously dumb things. I think it's about half an hour in before Elizabeth Banks and David Denman, who is Roy, by the way, from the US office, and is really good in this movie.
I really like him in this.
And both are doing fine work here, but it's about half an hour in before their freaky deaky space kid son, who's doing weird freaky deaky space kid shit, prompts the conversation going, do you think it might be because he's from space? Do you think it might be that?
It's like the we need to talk about Kevin thing, but it's like, oh, should we met? He's a fucking alien. How does this not come up until this point?
Like, he's eating forks.
I mean, when your psychopathic child is eating the cutlery, you've got... But the best part of that scene is he's eating the cutlery and the dad goes upstairs to tell the mum, gets distracted and then forgets to mention it. Like, it's not important. The kid just ate a fork.
Do you want to tell me anything interesting, Roy, from The Office?
It slipped my mind.
I'll be honest.
What it could have been.
Yeah.
No, it's gone.
So... 5 stars in for Brightburn.
Two stars.
Yes. Two stars in for Brightburn, and this is a great advert for gun control.
Oh dear.
True. Very true.
Now, James, you must leave us.
I must leave us because I wish to go home.
I must leave us.
I must leave us.
I must leave us.
The rest of you here. I'm going to go. I will.
He's going to slide into a hot bath of HP.
That's exactly what's going to happen. I'm going to lather up. It's going to be. It's going to be good. It's going to be good.
It'll be HP
so
all around.
All right. I will see you all next time.
Smelling slightly tangy. Perhaps a combination of spices, vinegar, and molasses.
Oh, it's molasses.
Don't mess
molasses. You know, have you ever read the ingredients on a bottle of HP sauce?
Well, apart from the Houses of Parliament.
You're missing out. It's like Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time, but smaller.
Hey, you are missing out on Wheel of Time. Okay. I'm so impressed, though, that you managed to mention spice, and he didn't mention the spice melange from the planet Dune. So call
don't
that away.
Don't say Dune within a 50-yard radius of James. He'll be back in a second, banging on relentlessly about Dune. All right, so that's one disappointing horror movie out of the way. Let's leave the other one to right near the end. Instead, let's talk about Toy Story 4 instead. Now, I have
Hooray.
Not seen Toy Story 4 yet.
I have.
Managed to miss every single screening because I am a strange, sad little man. And I have my own pity.
You have my pity too.
Thanks, Helen.
Yeah, so this is, we pick up a little bit, about a year or so, I think, after Andy gave all his old toys to Bonnie. Woody, Tom Hanks' character, obviously, is kind of struggling to adapt to his new position because he's no longer kind of the toy. He's no longer chief toy. He kind of is, you know, still addressed with respect by his fellow toys, but he's not played with as much. He's often left in the cupboard with her veteran toys, who, amusingly, are all voiced by comedians in their 80s and 90s, Betty White, people like that, which I enjoyed. He sees a chance to help one day. She's very, very nervous about going to kindergarten, and he goes with her, sneaks into her bag and goes with her. And there, she's on her own, and she's been kind of left by the other kids and is, again, really, really miserable. And he throws some art supplies at her to try and distract her and help her. And nobody sees him. It's okay. He's still a toy. It's all cool. But anyway, out of this stuff, she makes Forky, who's Tony Hale's character. Forky is now a toy and has sentience, but doesn't want it and believes himself to be trash. There's a metaphor there. And Woody basically has to keep him alive, as it were, and with Bonnie so that, you know, she will be comforted by his presence, because he's the only thing that has gotten her through her first day at kindergarten, and she needs him, is the idea. So that's the setup. And then, of course, Forky gets lost on a road trip.
No!
Woody has to go and help him.
What a prick.
And then, but the irony is, he's a spork. He's not even a fork, you know? Anyway, and on the way to try and find Forky, he meets up again with Bo Peep.
Is it a race against time?
Yes. Okay.
Where's Buzz Lightyear?
Buzz Lightyear is kind of doing very little. I'll be honest.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, he has a little subplot in this film, but it is very much a subplot, and he is separated from Woody for about 90% of the running time.
Is he arrested for cocaine possession at any point in this movie?
No, and that will never happen. Thank goodness for it. But no, this is a weird film because it's less about Woody and Buzz, which all of the others have been. It's more about Woody and Bo Peep, and we see what happened to her years ago and how she was given away and how that happened. And it kind of feels like they're trying to make us invest in this relationship without really necessarily having entirely earned it a little bit through all the other films. She was obviously in the first two, but again, it was a very small role. There was a relationship there with Woody, but it wasn't developed.
Wasn't she? Because I'll be honest, I'll fess up. I've only seen the Toy Story films a couple of times.
Oh my God.
I've only seen 2 and 3 once each. And I've seen, obviously, they're very good films, and Toy Story is a classic and hugely influential and important, of course. And I've seen that loads. But
of course.
Toy Story 2, isn't she the subject of the song When She Loved Me?
No, that's Jessie.
That's Jessie.
Yeah.
Jessie's the
Buzz's girlfriend, as it were.
Buzz's girlfriend. Mm. Now, she's the
cowgirl.
Cowgirl. Cowboy
Bo Peep
girl.
Bo Peep is a Bo Peep. Yeah.
Bo Peep is...
Bo is a Bo Peep.
Woody's girlfriend.
Yeah. Voiced by Annie Potts.
Annie Potts.
Yeah.
All right, okay.
So that's kind of the setup. So at one point he ends up in this antique store where he meets Christina Hendricks, Gabby Gabby, who's kind of the villain of the piece to an extent, maybe also not, I don't know. She has ventriloquist dummy henchmen, which is a very creepy addition.
Cool.
But more importantly, store is Duke Kaboom, Canada's best stunt toy.
Wait a second.
Yeah.
Played by...
Yeah, Keanu Reeves.
Oh my God.
We're bringing it full circle, man. It's all full circle. Anyway, so lots of, you know, great voice stuff in this. Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele turn up as prizes on a sort of carnival stand. They're great. There's lots of wonderful moments in this. It didn't hit me quite as hard as the other Toy Stories. I would consider all three of the others five-star masterpieces. I would agree with Dan's review of this one, which puts it at a four. Like, it's still ridiculously good. It's still better than 99% of other animation out there, but it is not quite as good as the other Toy Stories for me.
All right. Okay. Well, I'm going to check it out this weekend. I'll let you know whether you were correct.
Thanks so much.
Good. Okay. So 4 stars then for Toy Story 4. And then let's finish off this week with Child's Play. All right. So this is a remake of the 1988 film directed, of course, by Tom Holland. And
Tom Holland?
Yeah, Tom Holland.
Well, I didn't even think he was born then.
I know. Not that Tom Holland. So this is the remake of the 1988 film directed by Tom Holland.
Wait, was he not a historian?
Yeah,
right?
the other one. This is a remake of a 1988 film directed by Tom Holland.
The footballer?
No.
Wait, is it the director of Fright Night?
It's the director of Fright Night. So there we go. So this remake of the 1988 film directed by Tom Holland, director of Fright Night, and you know what it is. It has Chucky in it, right?
Killer doll.
Chucky, the killer doll, who is possessed by an evil serial killer, played in the original films, of course, by Brad Dourif, and went on to have varying degrees of success, I would say. It spawned 6 sequels with Don Mancini, mainly the creator of Chucky, at the helm of the franchise, and Brad Dourif hanging on as well as the voice of Chucky. And now this is a remake, and neither Mancini nor Dourif are involved because they're still off doing their own thing, and this has become quite the bone of contention. Apparently there's a hashtag saying #NotMyChucky, which seems fair, to be honest. So this is very much a remake of the first movie, and it updates Chucky for the modern generation. So now, instead of being possessed by a serial killer who uses the power of voodoo to possess the doll, this is now just a robot doll that is malfunctioning.
Oh.
Which is way less interesting.
Yeah, it is a bit.
I mean, there's a kind of thread that they try to develop, then they forget about, then they remember it at the end, and then they forget about it at the end as well, where he can connect to other products made by the same company, and he can connect to the cloud, and so he can learn stuff, and, you know, he can hook up to that microwave, or he can turn up the heating, or he can turn off your TV, and he can do all sorts of stuff.
Oh.
But they kind of forget about it, and it's not really important. He can connect to other dolls as well, possibly. But it's all rather unimaginative, ultimately.
Right.
And the first half of this movie is quite interesting because it recasts the story, kind of leans into the absurdity of the premise, he said, quoting his own review. And, you know, you have, it's a very dark, mordant comedy with Aubrey Plaza, who, you know,
great,
we love Aubrey Plaza,
love
as the single mother of Andy Barkley, the same characters from the original movie.
So it's an Andy
who has a toy.
Who has a toy,
yeah,
in the same week as Toy Story 4. I mean,
and
that's
this toy
be.
Comes to life.
Okay, and that's funny. And that's funny right there, right? Surely?
I mean, was Toy Story riffing on Child's Play?
I mean, maybe, but also this is definitely riffing then on Toy Story, maybe?
But it's the same character names from the first movie, so that's what I'm saying here. Was Toy Story riffing on Child's Play?
Whoa.
Anyway, if it is intentional, I don't think it was, because I think they're just using the names from the first movie, then that's about as witty as it gets.
Yeah, okay.
The first half hour or so is quite interesting because Aubrey Plaza is playing it quite off-kilter, and she's a young single mother, and, you know, she has some interesting deadpan line readings, as you might expect, because it's Aubrey Plaza. But the film does a couple of things which I thought kind of crippled it in the end. One is that everybody's unlikable.
Oh, that's
like,
not good.
Really unlikable. They've aged Andy up in this movie. He was quite a young kid in the first one, and that allowed you to root for him, and he didn't really have a character initially. But this kid's a bit of an unlikable douchebag who doesn't really fit in with anybody, and is really rude to Chucky, like, constantly, from the minute that he turns Chucky on, and Chucky's trying to bond with him, going, "You're my best friend." He's like, "Shut up, Chucky, I hate you," and all that sort of stuff. So that's a bit weird. You can't really root for anybody, with the exception, possibly, in fact, not possibly, I will say, with the exception of Brian Tyree Henry, who plays a local cop who lives down the corridor from them, and that's the Chris Sarandon role from the first movie, but everything's been changed.
Okay.
And spun on its head a little bit.
Well, he's generally reliable.
He's really good, but the movie doesn't give him enough to do. But everyone else is unlikable. So it's very hard to find a focal point, to find someone to root for. The second thing is the update. The updated Chuckito robot essentially means that you have a bad guy whose Achilles heel is you take the batteries out. And nobody does that. Nobody like says, oh, let's let the charge go down. I mean, the robot starts malfunctioning pretty much right away. It starts developing and displaying psychotic behavior pretty much from the off because it's had its violence inhibitors turned off. Now, you might even ask why this company have built these cute, well, allegedly cute looking dolls. I mean, the doll looks cheap and terrible as well, which may be part of the joke, but I've also got a feeling they just didn't have the budget to make it look good. That's my feeling. But why would you have a kid's plaything that has violence inhibitors? Just don't give it the capacity to be violent, surely.
I mean, did we learn nothing from Isaac Asimov's Rules of Robotics?
This is what I was yelling at the screen.
I know you were.
Yeah. But anyway, there's a couple of things, there's a couple of scenes that might work well for gore hounds, but the gore in this isn't anywhere near as inventive as it is in Brightburn, where there are a couple of really notable standout deaths. But the screening I went to of Child's Play the other night, I managed somehow to sit beside what I can only describe as an unsub in a future episode of Criminal Minds, RIP. Because every time there was a kill, he would just go, huh, nice.
Oh.
Huh, nice. And I was just like, oh God, I'm sitting beside my killer. So that was I was on edge for the rest of the movie. So
maybe that's why Hiller.
Mike Hiller. His name, yes, that's his name. His name was Mike Hiller. And he gets out a lot. People give him creepy looks and avoid him at parties.
Yeah.
And, you know.
So unfortunate.
Yes, yeah, so unfortunate. And I believe he's his good friend Michael Hunt is also victim of the same thing. But anyway. Hiller and Hunt.
And his pet dog, Mike Hat.
Anyway, I didn't like this film very much because it's full of really stupid people doing really, really stupid things, and you can almost see them run out of budget halfway through, which is really, which is kind of heartbreaking in a way. There's there's like meant to be a big launch of a doll towards the end of the movie, like in this supermarket set that they've clearly set up, and they want it to be Apple Store level stuff, and they've got like 30 disinterested extras standing at the back of the supermarket behind a red velvet rope trying to give it some atmosphere. Yay, countdown to the launch of this thing. And it's just, it's so bad.
Aww.
Which is a bit of a shame because there are things I did enjoy about it, but ultimately I gave this 2 of your Empire stars.
2 stars. So what we're saying is this week you should go and see Toy Story 4.
You should go see Toy Story 4, or you know, you could go see Endgame again and just kind of get it in your mind,
in your head,
and then you can make a direct comparison next week to the enhanced version, shall we say?
An enhanced. We have an enhanced in the field.
We do have an enhanced in the field.
Exciting.
Yeah, it is. So, well, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film related fun. We'll be joined by.
Don't look at me.
I've actually remembered this week. This is good. Hey. The star of Yesterday, Himesh Patel.
Hey.
Very exciting. And the director of In Fabric, Peter Strickland.
Cool.
See? We're Broadchurch here at Empire.
You can remember stuff. Look at that.
We've got Beatles and killer dresses. It's all happening. Anyway, until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it's goodbye from James Dyer. It's the best thing he said in weeks. Silence is golden. It is goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to recast Keanu Reeves in every single Carry On movie. I'm seeing him as a kind of Sid James figure. A charismatic rogue with an eye for the ladies and a hell of a cackle. Kind of thing.
Do you not see him more in the Carry On Up the Khyber as the sort of the young, handsome, you know, officer type?
Jim Dale?
Yeah.
Okay, why not?
Sure.
It might not be Jim Dale. It might be Roy Castle.
It's Roy Castle? Castle.
Roy Castle. Do I see Keanu Reeves as Roy Castle?
I do.
Yeah. Keanu Reeves record breakers. Helen and I are off to Dragon's Den. Is that how you pitch TV shows?
Sure.
I'm sure it is. Anyway, thanks for listening. See you next week.
Toodaloo.
Bye, dudes.